I got to tell you, this is an incredible amount of work that Dr. Jason Rand has put into his book, The Return of Planet X. And it answers a lot of questions that were not answered several years ago. We'll talk with him more about this in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Broadcasting out of a cave, Jason, in St. Louis, and I don't know if you can hear it, but the crickets are really starting to chirp these days. They know winter is right around the corner.
I tell you, nature, that's another thing I've learned, George. Nature is the most phenomenal creative essence in the universe, at least on this particular planet.
Oh, they're barometers. They know absolutely everything. And nature takes care of itself. How close will this Wormwood Planet X come to planet Earth?
Well, okay, let me jump right into that for you. Let me just refresh my theory on its approach, and then I'll get into some specifics. Our best research dates include late summer, which would be September in 2009, for X's first phase pass-through, and then in early winter, possibly December 2012, for X's second phase pass-through the solar system. In other words...
Okay, now, what do you mean by that? I'm confused, where if it comes around every 3,600 years, mm-hmm. how could it come through 2009 and then 2012 again? That's what I'm confused about when you talk about its phases.
Okay, well, remember we've stretched out our rubber band into this huge elliptical pattern. And we superimposed that rubber band over our solar system.
And to get from point A to B, around it, is what, 3,600 years,
approximately,
right?
Approximately 36 to 4,000. And that's governed by different celestial mechanics as they occur. Like, we know literally nothing of how deep space operates. We think we do. We're doing pretty good, but we've got a lot more to learn, like bending time and space, wormholes, and that kind of thing. Okay, so it takes its long, long outermost trip, 3,600 years, okay? And when it gets to the end of its loop, it comes swinging back in from the south, from behind the sun, and I believe it's going to pass somewhere just inside or just outside the orbit of Pluto. And even that far away, it's going to cause us disturbances. And as it's making its shorter turn now, see, the long period occurs on its way out. But when it comes back in, it makes a much shorter loop as it begins its return leg.
Okay.
Now, when it comes in, it's going to come up from under the plane of the ecliptic. And here's the startling part. It's coming in counterclockwise. In other words, its actual trajectory is clockwise. Our planets rotate in a counterclockwise rotation. When it comes in, it's going to come in counter to that, which means it's going to be in direct opposition to the normal rotation patterns, which are counterclockwise for our planets around the sun. Now, that mere fact alone is going to cause much more distress, because now you're putting the two magnets together. Got the picture?
Yes. Now, isn't it interesting that the Vatican has its own observatory? I believe it's in Arizona.
Yes, it is. And you know what? You can't get anywhere near it. You know who Father Malachi was?
Oh, yes.
Okay, well,
of course.
It's in the book, that whole theory of what happened to him and why he was ostracized and possibly lost his life is all in the book. That observatory that you're talking about, it's only one of at least a dozen that have been built by various countries and entities because they needed a better viewing situation. No, I firmly believe that the authorities know exactly what's coming about. Okay, back to our theory. As she's coming in on the short leg, we believe it's going to enter the solar system somewhere between Saturn and the asteroid belt. Now, that's what's going to cause the greatest amount of upheaval and damage.
Oh, no. You're telling me it's going to scatter some of these asteroids that are in that belt?
This is what we fear, and this is what a lot of other people like myself are talking about. At the same time, if we're lucky, when it sweeps through there, its gravitational field will suck these ones in that are prone to be loose.
Now, this is the first phase?
No, the first phase, it won't attract. It's already pushing and pulling in the debris field.
Okay.
And remember, if I'm right, it's got Nibiru in tow on top of everything else.
With the possibility of incredible extraterrestrial life on it.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. So as she's coming through on her return leg in December of 2012, I believe that what could take place could be a catastrophic tipping of the Earth's poles. I do want to read something directly from the book. I want to quote it if I can because it's perfectly written and it's needed to be stated at this point. Pole shifts, that means slippages of the Earth's crust, usually take place only 20% of the time. The brown dwarf's orbital period is approximately every 36 to 4,000 years. Therefore, pole shifts may only take place on average once every 20,000 years, 20% of the time.
Mm-hmm.
Now, let's keep in mind that pole shifts can be massive, involving large changes in Earth's crustal placement, or at times could be minor, involving very slight changes in Earth's crustal positions. However, if large upheavals in the Earth's crust take place, George, the geophysical effects can be much greater than if only small changes occur. Anyway, large or small, any and all Earth-changing movements are certainly going to prove dangerous and difficult for us here on the planet, as well as affecting all the other planets in our solar system. And it could also affect the moon. Let's not forget that body is governed by our rotation principles.
Would it alter the moon's rotation?
It could alter its trajectory. I'm not sure, but it's possible because of X's huge mass. What I've done in the book is I'd like to review this real quick with you. We have basically 11 chapters. The first chapter is actually an introductory overview. It's called Earthwatch, the 21st Century and Beyond. It brings you into the substance of the book in terms of modern-day phenomena that are happening and its connection to the book. Chapter 1 is called Messages from the Past. We study in detail all of the legends, all of the writings, all of the pictographs, everything that points from what people knew about it in the past pointing to the future.
What did the ancients know about Wormwood or Planet X?
They knew a heck of a lot more than any of us realized. All we have to do is, and what we did in the book, is basically start finding the evidence. There's tons of evidence. Chapter 2, Forbidden Archaeology. Where does it occur? It occurs in the archaeological digs, both near and far around the world. We clearly analyze it. We give all of the evidence. We even tell you where to find it. Then we shift to Chapter 3, Shifting Sands, Shifting Poles, where we present evidence of this archaeology and what happens as a result of X's passage. Thereby, the messages of the past point to the shifting sands and shifting poles.
Are we shifting now?
Oh, yes. Just came across a website supposedly quoting information from NASA and the SOHO satellites where Earth's rotation and Earth's axis has shifted 26.5 degrees.
That's pretty dramatic, Jason,
yes,
isn't it?
I wish I had. Maybe in our next break, I'll try to find that website for you.
All right.
And give it to the audience. Moving forward, we then go to Chapter 4 where we talk about phantom astronomy. There is a ton of evidence in astronomical records, and there are hundreds and hundreds of books available that talk about this. All the reader has to do is to take it one step at a time, and that's what we did. We didn't want to make it a complicated book. It has to be readable by the general public. And so I wrote it in a very low-key way, you know, trying to stay away from facts and figures and all this kind of things. Once you understand the astronomy, then we examine in Chapter 5 the signs of X's approach. And these were exhibited, as I mentioned earlier, in the Hebrew Exodus, when Moses brought about what we believe were miracles. All of these effects, burning as a lamp in the sky, the sudden weather changes, the hot and the cold, all of these things are signs of its approach.
Might it have affected Noah in the flood?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And if you go back, it was about 3,600 years past the Exodus that Noah had his experience.
Isn't that fascinating?
It all ties together. That's what's so fascinating about the subject that we're talking about. It's no one isolated, insulated subject or situation. It all ties together. And
well, I've always said, Jason, that mm-hmm. the Mayans talked about 2012 and that we're talking about some kind of solar celestial event. I've always said that.
Exactly. They knew more than we know now. And if we only had access to some of the ancient Aztec and Mayan writings, which were systematically destroyed, as you know, by the missionaries that came through there, I'm sure that, you know, back in the 15 and 1600s,
right,
we would have so much more information available to us. And, you know, that once again, I'm not pinging on religion, but it's terrible what happens to history, like when Caesar accidentally burned down the library at Alexandria. What a loss that must have been.
What a tragedy that was.
However, I think that there are books, that the books of the Alexandria Library are duplicated in the large library room underneath the right paw print of the Sphinx. I've done some research into that, but that's another program.
Then you get into the ancient science of prophecy.
And here's where we tie it all together. We tie the messages from the past, the archaeology, the effects, the shifting sands, shifting poles. We tie the astronomy into the signs of its approach, because you'll see it. And suddenly, the ancient science of prophecy completely and totally unifies the subject. It gives it to you in clear verbiage and a clear picture so that you can actually see what's going to happen. Now, once I've exposed all this information to the reader, then in chapter 7, 8, and 9, 7 is called Order Out of Chaos. What will happen once we unfortunately pull out of it? It also goes into government preparation. Chapter 8 is self-sufficiency. We totally talk about the need for each family head being responsible to the family, and then each member of the family being responsible to every other member of the family, then the relatives, then the community, then the church, then the state, and then the nation. You see, George, we're all in this thing together. When Katrina and Rita hit, New Orleans was literally blown off the map. But what did we do? We came back. We came back as a nation. What is it? We spent, a couple of $100 billion there now already? Something like that.
Even though some want to take advantage of that.
Well,
that's a different story.
That's another story, and that's, George, that's human nature. You know, we're not going to get away from that. Now, the last thing we talk about in the book is personal preparations. We give you a complete countdown in easy steps how to prepare for any calamity. George, not just the potential return of Planet X, but what to do in terms of hurricanes and storms and tornadoes and wildfires.
In your opinion, and yes, this sir. Is all speculation, 6.5 billion people on the planet, this return occurs, how many people die?
About half of the world's population could very possibly perish. George, they lost 225,000 people in an hour and a half 2 years ago when that tsunami hit Indonesia. 245,000 people ceased to exist in an hour and a half. Now, if we make the tragedy 100-fold or 1,000-fold more dramatic and more damaging, what can we expect? People still live at the edge of on the edge of their continent at the ocean's edge. There'll be hundreds of millions of people that will never survive the tsunamis that will occur, especially if a major pole shift occurs. Now, let me say this. If the Earth's crust moves as dramatically as I fear that it will, you're going to get whacked no matter where you are. But there are certainly places that are much, much safer. Do not be near large bodies of water like oceans and lakes or rivers. Listen, I only live 18 miles from the Mississippi River at this point, okay? I'm just outside Memphis in the northeast corner of the northwest corner.
I'm just outside of it in St. Louis.
I know. George, if the East Coast lifts and empties the Great Lakes, where will the water naturally flow to?
In the Mississippi.
Can only go there. It can only go there because that's been a natural pathway for water for what they estimate now to be at least a million years or more.
And we both know the Mississippi can't take that much water.
Of course not. So what I fear is, and I probably am going to make an adjustment. I'm going to wait and see how 09 and 010 looks. Because I'm very comfortable here. I love it. It's just a little small town, a little Confederate war town, and people are very, very nice. But the point of the matter is we need to go inland and away from large bodies of water. Also, all those people that are living in Hawaii have to be extremely careful because there will be a series of dramatic volcanic eruptions there and around the world. I greatly fear for the northwest part of the United States. I spent 3 years in Portland, traveled much up into the state of Washington. I've toured all the mountains as part of the research for my book, you know, did the Shasta climb and all that stuff. If this thing breaks loose like I fear, you can kiss the Northwest goodbye. And I say that with trepidation because I fear for the millions and millions of people who will either not listen to what I'm saying, and not that I'm a prophet, mind you. I'm just sharing the information that I believe needs to be shared with your listening audience and the world and the public at large.
Do you know if Edgar Cayce had said anything about Wormwood in any of his trance readings?
I don't know. Boy, that is an excellent... Yes, he does. I do have a section in the book relegated to Edgar Cayce, but I don't know if he mentions the word Wormwood, but he does talk about celestial phenomena. Yes, the answer is yes, and it is in our book. It's in the prophecy.
Do you believe Planet X, by 2012, mm-hmm. will cause, let's say, North America to greatly change physically?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. There are a series of very interesting maps and prognostications out on the Internet. There's probably more than 1,000 websites devoted to the subject of Planet X, either in terms of calling it, you know, Nibiru or Planet X or Wormwood. So I would invite your listeners to go and seek out the rich field of information that occurs on the Internet. And once again, even if you feel, you know, well, you know, I don't see how that could possibly be true, or, oh, come on, that sounds too crazy. Where there's smoke, there's fire. And that's why when we wrote the book, we decided to go to the core of the information. Hundreds of books written by other people. We've examined all the archaeology and the astronomy and the prophecy. And like I said, Chapter 6 ties this whole schematic of Planet X together. What I would like to do is invite every person listening to your show to keep an open mind about your show tonight. And if there is any question, certainly call in for the last hour of the show. I'll be happy, you know, to field as many calls as we can. Like I said, our website is returnofplanetx.com. It has information how to reach me on my own email site. And by the way, I do answer my mail. And I do answer my emails as best I can and as timely as I can.
Good. Now, is there any governmental agency that has contacted you because of your work?
Not contacted me in terms of wanting to have me participate in anything. But as I have mentioned to you, the Arlington Institute, which is one of the largest think tanks in the country, requested a book. The Heritage Foundation requested a book. I have sent a book to the White House. And several congressmen.
You've not been told to shut it down.
Nope, not at all. And I am so grateful.
Well, stay with us. Stay with us. We'll talk more when we come back. Sure is. And I got to tell you, of every riveting theory I've heard about Planet X, Wormwood, this one makes a lot of sense. I mean, he ties in biblical prophecy, which I've been a very strong believer on, with science and some of the other things we know. And these earth changes that are happening, they're happening right around this period. We'll be back with more with Dr. Jason Rand on Coast to Coast AM. So, Dr. Rand, are the signs out there now for us to see, or will we not see them until 2009?
Okay, how about if I pop this one on you?
All right.
Earth calendar date in fall of 2007 finds our fragile blue world in really dire crisis. Just turn on the television. Let's consider the facts of overpopulation. How about global warming? And I will talk about that in a second. We've got a badly depleted ozone layer, rainforest devastation. We've got uncontrollable wildfires. Look what happened in Greece. We've got increased hurricanes. Now they're going. Now all of them are Cat 3, 4s, and 5s. We've got Pacific typhoons that have been nastier than ever. We've got storms within the center of the country. Tornadoes. We had a tornado in Brooklyn. When was the last time you remember hearing about a tornado in Brooklyn?
Never in recorded history.
Never. Okay. Now, with these tornadoes comes unbelievable flooding, and now we're seeing tsunamis coupled with droughts. That's a weird situation. We've got Arctic and Antarctic meltdowns. We've got mass extinctions of multiple plant and wildlife species in almost every category. Then we've got widespread famines and deadly disease outbreaks, not only human, but animal origins. We've got ever-increasing worldwide earthquake and volcanic activity, some estimate up as much as 400%. Now, George, all of this collectively takes a huge toll on human, plant, and animal life, certainly not to mention the billions upon billions of dollars blown in global property damage, lost wages, the suffering economy, and major consumer disruptions to the everyday needs of the global citizens. I hypothecate that Mother Nature takes no prisoners, she gives no quarter, and she remains totally uncontrollable. Now, if those signs aren't enough to wake everyone up, what do we have to do? Do we actually have to have the pole shift occur? I think that what we really need to do is we need to listen to various people and authors and speakers who are trying to tell us what they believe is wrong with the planet. Could we talk about global warming for just a second?
Sure. And let's get your take on what you think causes it. I think mankind may be helping it a little bit, but I think we are in a cycle.
There's no question that we're in an up cycle, and it has probably a fair amount of responsibility thrown into the production of CO2 by the human race. But I'm going to go out on a limb here. In part of my research, I found that every time a volcano blows, it spews hundreds and hundreds of tons of CO2 into the atmosphere. Did you know that Vesuvius has started erupting again?
Yep, sure did.
In the southern tip of Italy.
Yes.
Every time one of these volcanoes blows its lid, like when St. Helens went, it adds huge, huge amounts of pollutants and gases and things like CO2 into the atmosphere, far greater than any amount of cars could do. However, I do believe that as the industrial age came about, the current escalation of CO2 in the atmosphere also came into play. Now, I'm going to go a little bit deeper into this. We always talk about volcanic activity above the surface of the oceans. No one is looking at the after effects and the ever-increasing amount, degree, and ferocity of the undersea volcanoes that are now erupting more than ever. Can you imagine how much heat one of these huge volcanoes displaces at the sea bottom? And it affects the currents, and it affects every aspect of how the oceans work, how they create weather, how they govern weather, how they can predict weather for us.
I agree. It's like simmering a pot, isn't it?
It's simmering a pot. And, you know, when you have an Hawaiian-type shield volcano like Mauna Loa, which is of gigantic proportions, and it represents the largest volcanic formation on Earth. And apart from other basaltic plateau volcanoes, Mauna Loa including its underwater part, listen to this, is about 10,000 meters or 33,000 feet in height from the numbers from the floor of the ocean to the tip of it in the atmosphere. And it has a base diameter of 250 miles. Plus, it's been an active venting volcano for the past 75 years. Now, why aren't we investigating that? Why aren't we looking into that? I cannot believe, George, that they just haven't thought about it. But, of course, we can't do anything about volcanoes now, can we?
Well, here we are again then, though some people think we can dump things in them. I'm not sure that works. Plug them up.
Okay.
I don't think it works.
No, it doesn't. It hasn't up to the present, so I don't think it's a good solution.
Do you believe that there is a clandestine black ops program, a group of scientists working on behalf of the government somewhere in some dark laboratory on the return of Planet X?
Oh, that's such a great point that you brought up. Okay, it's time to talk about my proposed film and TV series. Knowing me like you do in just this one conversation, don't doubt that I leave any stones unturned. I have a complete television series written talking about what I believe is a, quote, clandestine group of, let's call them political officials around the world who are engaged in a massive cover-up. I call them the Illuminati.
Okay, and the Illuminati. Would they be scientists, politicians?
Yes.
All these, okay.
And I'm not trying to tell you that they're evil, wicked people. I think that there is a cadre of scientific thinking and political strength and huge money being put into an effort to actually help prepare the planet, but they're doing it very quietly and very secretly. Imagine what would happen when and if mass hysteria breaks out. Look what happened in New Orleans. Was that any example to anybody?
So what happens with Wormwood if it is out there when you say it begins to be seen? What are people going to do?
Well, I think, as I mentioned a little earlier, I think very, very logically that this information will be slowly, slowly disseminated to the public. And I think it's going to start probably a year or so after the 08 election.
How do we know the government, Jason, hasn't asked you to publicize this?
They haven't. Trust me, they haven't.
All right,
I'm very forthright with you.
Okay.
I'll be straight up, and anybody can look into my background. They can do whatever they want to. No,
I have not
been prompted or tempted or suggested to or thwarted or threatened or anything. I'm very, very fortunate. I've done other things for the government. I used to work at, you ever, China Lake?
Oh, yeah. We've heard about it.
In Ridgecrest?
Yep.
Well, I was part of an elect team of writers and technicians. I could talk about it now. I couldn't talk about it then. I had to sign a 10-year disclaimer. I was part of a team that worked at Ridgecrest at a company called Comarco. It was a large company located off base. I lived there for like 7 years. And I worked on a project, top secret project, to figure out why the cruise missile couldn't hit its target for the first 4.5 years of its deployment. Did you know that?
Why couldn't it?
Well, it was very, very simple. These missiles are guided by video cameras that record the terrain that it's passing over, and that information is then interpreted by the internal computer from a pre-programmed program that's inserted into the missiles so that they know where their targets are. Right. When these missiles would reach their precise speed, which I won't discuss, what happens was the intense friction of the air and the atmosphere hitting the nose cone, which was totally clear plastic, it made the nose cone go opaque. And when it went opaque, the television camera could not record where it was going, and the missile simply went wherever it wanted to or until it ran out of fuel.
It went blind, basically.
It went totally blind. Now, no one knew this. This was a very closely held secret. That's another show we can do, by the way.
Well, then why didn't they know it? Because they couldn't find the missiles, I guess, right?
No, it couldn't find its range, its target range, because it was blinded.
Well, I know, but once it was, but people didn't know the shield was getting
taped
up because they couldn't find the missiles.
Exactly. It took us about 5 years and over $200 million to figure out what was wrong. And incidentally, every time we fired one off, it was $5 to $10 million at a crack. Gosh. Testing them. We tested hundreds of missiles off ships.
It was the plastic.
It was the plastic nose cone. It didn't have enough thickness of Mylar ribbing, like thin ribbons of material. It's a little complicated, and I don't want to stray off into that. But the point of the matter is, I've had a lot of service with the government. There's a file on me like there is on every ufologist. I've spent time in Russia. I've been to Star City. Did I mention that to you?
No.
I've been to Star City.
That's outside of Moscow, right?
Yes, it's outside of Moscow. Do you know who Dr. Marina Popovich, Lieutenant Colonel Popovich, Russian UFO specialist, and her husband, Pavel?
Wasn't she a pilot?
Yes.
Okay.
One of the most famous test pilots in the world. I became good friends with her at the 1991 first UFO World Congress that was hosted by Wendell Stevens.
She is a believer, right?
Oh, she heads up their secret UFO investigative committee, her and her husband. They're not married now, but together they still are involved with this.
Did you tell her as a kid you would go up to another star system?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. She and I have had many talks.
In fact,
talking to her tomorrow. She's calling me from Moscow tomorrow. We're thinking I have some interested people in Hollywood who want to do her life story as a feature film, which I think would be just wonderful.
It's an interesting life story. But when you told her, hey, I've gone to this Epsilon star system.
So has she.
Oh, really?
Different contacts. Her contact started when she was a child of 6 or 7. She distinctly remembers during the blitzes that came against Russia by the German bombers, she would be comforted and spoken to by the ETs, telling her not to worry, that her destiny was secure, that she would, you know, one day become a beacon of light for her people. She's a fascinating personality, and there's another show for you.
Well,
by the way, if you'd like to have her on, I could certainly arrange that for you.
How's her English?
Well, she'll speak through an interpreter, but you'll hear her speaking. And then the interpreter will be right behind her.
All right. Well, we'll kick it around. I don't know if I can do a full show with her based on an interpreter, but it's well worth
thinking. No, I understand,
about.
But it would be certainly worth a segment. In any event, she and I have been planning and working, and the book now is going to be given to the Russian the society that I belong to. They're going to be getting copies of the book. I've already sent them, as a matter of fact, and it's going to be translated into Russian for the entire Russian community. Incidentally.
Well, let me
Russian
ask you,
people have a great belief in UFOs.
I was going to ask you, of course, Pravda has a story every day, but I mean, do they believe in the return of Planet X?
Yes, they do. Their scientists are very tuned into this. See, she helped me. I must tell you, she's given me moral support and intellectual support. I was very afraid to come forward with this book. I must tell you that.
Why?
Well,
career, reputation?
Don't they usually kill the messenger?
Sometimes. Depends on what the message is.
Well, this message could be very sticky for our planet. But I think it's a message which has to be told, it has to be shared, and it has to be explained. There's no need to fear the future.
So here's the problem, Jason. Until we see this happen,
right,
and you and I both know, they will put you into a category of he's out there.
Yep. Get
here's
the
another.
Coat.
Here's another story.
Yep.
Hey, this guy is, you know, let him do his thing. Even though they may know it's true, they're going to publicly tell the world that you are a whack job.
But the subject of the book and the way it's written will dispel that notion being spread wide forth, because what I say in the book and how I approach the subject and the fact that I'm on shows like yours will help me get this message out. And there's an old saying, you can't hide the truth under a bushel.
Well, this is one of the first presentations that to me has some meaning behind it. It makes sense. that if you believe in all these other facets that you seem to have put together, these pieces of a puzzle, that it makes sense. There have been scientists who have talked about a binary star system.
Yes.
They just don't know where the other one is.
Exactly.
And that could be Wormwood.
Absolutely. And the interesting thing is that although this seems to be a complex subject, it really isn't at all. And that's how I designed the book. And by the way, Marina gave me insight. She's written dozens of books, by the way. And what she told me to do was just tell the story as you believe it happened and put it in a chronological order. And that's how we came up with chapters 1 through 9. The epilogue of our book, by the way, is called Prelude to Our 2012 Planet X Countdown. And in the epilogue, George, what we do is we recount all of the substance that came through chapters 1 and 9, and we put it into a fairly clearly perspective as it relates to today's events, the weather, the changes, the interest of people in the UFO ET phenomenon. Once again, George, I maintain that the public is very savvy.
Well, there's no doubt about it. What do you prefer, to call it Planet X or Wormwood?
Either one.
Preference?
Either
okay.
one. The title of the book is The Return of Planet X. And the reason I chose that title was because the topic of Planet X is so prevalent on the Internet. It allowed me to converse in a way and in a manner which the public will relate to. Like I said, just Google up Planet X and you're going to get 1,000 pages of references. Incidentally, when you Google up The Return of Planet X, guess whose book comes up first? I'm very fortunate in that.
There you are. You're lucky to be up there that high.
Yes, I am. And I so appreciate your show tonight. I got to tell you.
Well, it's good information. And now I want you to give us, and we're coming up to the top of the hour, so we don't have much time here.
Yes.
And we're going to take phone calls next hour.
Yes.
But are you saying the signs of this are there now?
All over the place. Just turn on the television. What happens on the Weather Channel? Are they talking about nice weather? Are they talking about how great everything is? It's about storms and floods and fires and tornadoes and earthquakes like never, ever before. Most newscasts on most major networks and cable, 25% of the news is devoted to disasters. Track it sometime. You will be astounded at what percentage of the content is about extreme weather.
Oh, and it's huge.
It's global. It's not just the United States, although we're getting our fair share of it. See, we just don't hear what's going on in China and Russia and all these other countries. Poor South America, the floods and the fires. Well, we heard about Greece because that was so prominent. Have you ever heard of forest fires racing through Greece? I don't
never,
think so.
Never until recently.
Okay, we're breaking all records with the weather. People simply have to read the signs. I've got a quote.
Well, yeah, but the Grease fires could have been deliberately set.
Well,
I'm pretty sure they
think
were.
That they might have been, but the fact of the matter is that they were. Well, the lesson from that is they were totally unprepared. What a great lesson this could be for them in facing a natural disaster such as this. Let me leave you with a thought. Have you ever thought about what reality really is, George?
I think about it a lot.
The ETs told me that reality, as it is perceived by each human being, is the sum total of their individual cumulative life experiences on a moment-to-moment basis.
Stay with us. We're going to open up the phone lines next with Dr. Jason Rand on Coast to Coast AM.